to make this? Oh, this goes. It does it automatically. How wonderful. Thank you all for being here. This session is on the burden of asthma on schools. And these are my compatriots in this. And Simran Sabharwal is with us at the back of the room. Thank you for being here. And we also have no financial relationships to any of this work, except that we work for the University of California, where we do research on health disparities and access. Okay, what we're going to talk about today are some data on absences, achievement, and air quality, some of the gaps in knowledge, some of where we can go next in terms of looking at these types of data, and some of the priorities, and a brief overview of programs. The research questions for this study were trying to look at how much of a burden asthma presents for schools. From anecdotal evidence, it seems pretty clear that there's a really strong burden. However, as we started looking at the studies, it became trickier to document that. And also what types of programs then facilitate getting children onto a track where they are resilient and become contributing members to their society. Absences obviously are an economic burden to schools. Schools get paid on something called the ADA, the Average Daily Allowance. So children are literally paid, schools are paid, for having children in place in schools. Also, clearly, having a child in school is an opportunity to learn. In terms of achievement, if you have absences, you're missing out on that opportunity to learn and improve life and health. Test scores are important, but they're obviously not the whole story. And in terms of affecting the life course, being in school gives one the opportunity to supplement home and community activities and create resilient children who are ready to learn. The literature and the experts. Okay. There are a lot of limitations to the studies that look at asthma in schools. The methodological issues alone. There are inconsistent definitions for asthma. There's a lack of specificity often that schools have about the reasons for absence. There's a lack of control groups, and there's also a real lack of trend data. So you don't have that sense of what happens over years so that you can say, oh, that was a bad flu year. So of course that was an anomaly. For school absenteeism, virtually all of the studies demonstrate a correlation between asthma and increased school absences. And these studies tend to range between 4 to 10 days per year that is accountable to asthma. And in California, almost 14% of our children have asthma, and slightly over 16% of our adolescents have asthma. So in this state, this is a real epidemic. This is a group of studies that look at absences over a one-year period, absences per child. And you can see that in this group, it goes from 1.3 to over 18%, I'm sorry, to over 18 days. Of missed school. And then this is a group of studies that actually break down by severity what the asthma looks like. So your green bars are the children with more severe asthma, and the mild are the orange ones. So you start to see how this plays out if one teases out the data in this way in your study. So, but looking at it slightly differently, if you look at all of the children with asthma who are under 12 who miss at least one day of school, then you see that those kids miss, on average, 5.2 days of school. And if you look at, in California again, 7 to 11% of our kids miss 11 or more days of school. So it seems really clear that the increased asthma severity correlates with increased absenteeism. And a sidebar to that is the issue of nighttime awakenings. It's possible to have kids who are in their seats in school, but who just haven't received enough sleep or are not really alert enough to fully participate in school. So there's a whole other dimension in that piece. So while we don't have solid evidence that links asthma to absences to achievement, there does seem to be a correlation there in a number of studies. And there also are studies that are strongly suggestive that ventilation in the school room has a major effect on kids being able to learn. In fact, one of our colleagues has put together a little brief that basically says how to have your kids score badly on tests. You know, don't have good air quality in the room. You'll have sleepy students. You'll have a sleepy teacher. Everybody will be a little bit grumpy, and it sort of then walks through a few other piece of that. Oh, and there almost are no studies that look at lifetime achievement and that trend data that you'd like to be able to take to policymakers to say, look, invest here. This is what you get as bang for your buck, and this is what you get in terms of kids. Okay, in Southern California for a 2003 study, Okay, sorry, didn't mean to skip over the environmental data. Let's move upstream. In Los Angeles County, school absences rose by over 80% when community ozone levels increased by 20 parts per billion. And some of you probably know this, but there's getting to be stronger and stronger data about where schools are located in relationship to heavy traffic patterns. The study that I cite here talks about schools that are within 200 meters of heavy traffic pattern. Those schools have children who have lower lung volumes than kids who are at schools that are further away from heavy traffic. And there's a new study out last week, I think, that actually reduces this to 75 meters. In California, again, in 2004, 2% of our schools were located within 150 meters of heavy traffic, and over 7% were within 300 meters. So there's a gradient here. The closer you are to heavy traffic and diesel, the worse your kids are going to do. And of course, we have more non-white students and poor students. So children from communities of color are more likely to be in these schools that are closer to these heavy traffic patterns, and this may be one of the factors that contributes to the higher asthma prevalence in communities of color. In a 2003 study, some of our colleagues actually looked at reduced ozone levels, and they thought that it would result in over 900,000 reduced school absences, which would contribute more than $40 million that are currently lost. Okay, so it's really likely that asthma absences are very similar to what you see here in terms of asthma costs. These actually are old data that come from the Center for Healthcare Strategies, but I used it because it gives you a real clear idea of the relationship. So it's probable that in the same way that you have one quartile of children with asthma who have severe asthma, who really need the type of wraparound services to stabilize them and their family, that's what's going on with absences. And if you were to average this high quartile group with the others, obviously you're going to lower your overall mean. So So that's one of the things that we're starting to look at to get a better handle so that we can take this evidence to schools. I want to talk just briefly about the kinds of school programs that make a difference. One of our core concepts is looking at resilience and how to increase healthy youth so that they can contribute to their communities and to society in general. And this is a model that Bonnie Bernard and some of her colleagues at WestEd have developed. And as you can see, it looks at developing protective factors in children, which involve caring relationships with adults, creating high expectation for the children, and having them able to participate in meaningful activities. I don't think we have a lack of that latter in either the country or the world at the moment. And then this, in turn, leads to enhanced human development and systems change, which provides successful outcomes, and then, of course, the loop repeats. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the school-based program model, but I'd like to point out just a couple of components in the inner circle there. The tailored environmental interventions are important, not only the social environment, but also the physical environment, the strong community ties, and the committed program champions. Ideally, you create a loop there between your champions and your community ties, so that you create a self-fulfilling pipeline and you're able to continue to recruit champions from the community who are able to enhance that work and keep that sustainable. These are the people who were extremely helpful to us in this work, and we were funded by the California Endowment. Thank you, everyone. And this is my contact information. Thank you, and I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Okay. And that's it for our speakers. Do we have any questions from anyone?
I actually have a question.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
You're not allowed to ask, right?
My question is actually for you. Oh. In your studies, you found that access to the school health centers helps reduce asthma, mental health costs. Mm-hmm. It might seem obvious, the answer, but how did you explain it to people, that why access to the health centers reduces costs?
Have people?
Yeah, like improved efficiencies, or the school health center services are better, less expensive?
I would say that when we explain that to people is that the school health centers, when they opened, they were just trying to figure out how to open and operate at that time. So the first 3 years of operation, they didn't have anything that was specifically targeted towards asthma. Their mental health services increased, so every year they provided more mental health services as response to the demand of their students. But they weren't targeting, and they weren't planned interventions, even though they, at this point in time, they all have more specific, and several of them have really directed asthma programs. But our explanation of that is that students who have regular, ongoing, consistent access to primary care services lowers their hospital and ED costs.
Okay.
And that was the students who used the school-based health centers, who were students who didn't have access before that opened or had very difficult accessing them, because there were obviously students who chose not to use school health centers. And when you look at their other data, they had they were accessing services elsewhere. I have no explanation for why the prescription costs went down. We have looked and asked to figure out why. None of the sites hand out, they didn't dispense on site. They obviously wrote prescriptions, but they didn't have pharmacies on site to give out the prescription care. So my guess is they just prescribed more general, overall, they're more generic meds. We can't really explain why the prescription costs dropped.
Care, whether or not they,
I can answer from our end on how that works, but I'm sure you all have answers to that too. That's something that pops up everywhere, and it's something you have to address. And I'm actually dealing with it now in one of my rural communities as they're designing a school health center. I've been talked to their local pediatric practice twice within the last week. And from what we saw in our study is that the students, and just by experience only, is that the students who use the school health centers are students who don't use traditional services. And there wasn't and hasn't been in the last 10 years we've been doing that a loss of patients from the private pediatric practices. And we had to deal with that. When we opened a bunch in Northern Kentucky, the main practices came in, and we had a lot of community discussions about it. And we've had centers in Lexington for years, and the physician who operates those, luckily, was a professor. Most of them all had at UK, and he was a trusted pediatric voice to them, and he explained to them that the kids who typically use school health centers aren't the students who typically show up in your office, and that it's not going to be competition. It has turned out to be that it has not been a competition for those private practices. Anybody else want to answer that?
Without knowing anything about the data from Cincinnati, one of the things that happens in school-based health programs is that it is the access issue. It's also having the convenience factor of kids who can use something at school. We have seen within schools in the Bay Area a number of kids who have activity-induced asthma, who have a really difficult time coordinating between their activities at school and a community provider. So it's mostly anecdotal, and it's mostly what I get from the school health nurses who were stretched incredibly thin. But there does seem to be that access and convenience factor, plus the fact that a lot of these kids are involved in sports at school. So it helps create a little circle that is easier to navigate, I think, than it is having your asthma action plan coordinated with other folks. Other comments?
Our school health centers serve mostly adolescents, and so a lot of these teens weren't accessing primary care services anyway. A lot of the providers community clinics that serve as the medical providers in these clinics, and we actually are able to refer to those clinics for other services if need be. But the biggest argument we have is they weren't getting mental health services, they weren't getting reproductive health services, and now they are, at least through our centers. It's probably a different story in elementary schools, I would imagine.
Any other questions?
So basically, one of the scenarios, and this was one that as we were doing the exploratory piece that the school nurse who was at our meeting in July sort of came up with, is that she, because there's only 2.25 nurses spread over 16 schools, they can't, obviously when there's, a kid who's got a headache or a bellyache, who makes the triage decision but the school administrative assistant, the secretary, who is, basically sees a kid and is, calling the parent saying, Johnny's got a headache, come get him. And so what they envisioned was being able to have the child in front of the video conferencing unit and talk to Johnny about what's going on with the headache. Did he eat breakfast this morning? Ask some good, questions and actually be able to make a triage decision with the goal of keeping the kid in school if he doesn't need to go home. And so that's a really easy sort of example of how that would work. Now, with the primary care providers, the way that the primary care folks were talking about this is that they would like their little webcam on the computer. Many of them are on electronic records already. They've got a computer in their office, and they would just like a little webcam so that the school nurse could call them with a question about a child, whether it was a rash, whether it was, something like, we finally have completed the ADHD assessment tools, and I want to go over the results with you, but that they would be able to do so video conferenced. So those are some of the ideas. And then the subspecialty consultation would primarily occur between the primary care provider and the developmental and behavioral pediatrician, and that could happen, you know, in some kind of training type of, or having the child and parent in the primary care provider's office doing the subspecialty consultation. And that's the model that UC Davis has used for weight management, for HIV care, and more recently for child abuse evaluations. So.
There is.
It's not great, and there's lots of advocacy going on around it. But the rural primary care providers would be able to bill for their time that they're providing the consultation to the school, and which is also why we really want to work on using evidence-based assessment tools so they can actually do the additional billing for having done a behavioral screen. And similarly, there's a sort of consultation reimbursement that subspecialists can. Seek reimbursement for. So it's pretty cool.
That's our time. Thank you all very much. Enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
So tell us where you go.
I will.
You know, you